From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Merry Christmas. We're celebrating the holiday week with our series Words and Music, featuring songwriters performing their own songs. Today, the Cole Porter of the Kitty Set, Jeff Moss. He was one of the original songwriters for Sesame Street, and we'll hear him sing and talk about such classics as Rubber Ducky and I Love Trash. Also, a performance by the McGarrigle sisters, including their best-known song, Heart Like a Wheel. That's all coming up on this Christmas edition of Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Merry Christmas. We're celebrating the holiday week with a series called Words and Music, featuring songwriters performing their own songs. Cole Porter wrote songs for Ethel Merman. Jeff Moss writes for Miss Piggy, Oscar the Grouch, and Cookie Monster. Unlike Ethel Merman, Miss Piggy is never gracious enough to credit her songwriter, but we'll give him his due today. Moss has been a songwriter for Sesame Street since the show premiered 27 years ago. He's also served as the show's head writer. The songs he wrote for the film The Muppets Take Manhattan earned him an Oscar nomination. He's won 4 Grammys. His best-known song, Rubber Ducky, was a top 40 hit. Moss also writes children's books. 2 years ago, we invited Jeff Moss to join us at the piano in our studio to sing some of the songs that turned the Muppets into stars. Jeff Moss, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
Why don't we start with the song that's your chart buster? It actually made it to, I think, number 16 on the Billboard chart.
Something like that. Back a few years ago, the highest on the charts ever, I think, for a song sung by a guy in a bathtub. A rubber ducky, you're the one. You make bath time lots of fun. Rubber ducky, I'm awfully fond of you. Vovodio, rubber ducky, joy of joys. When I squeeze you, you make noise. Rubber ducky, you're my very best friend, it's true. Oh, every day when I make my way to the tubby, I find a little fellow who's cute and yellow and chubby. Rub-a-dub-dubby, rubber ducky, you're so fine. And I'm lucky that you're mine. Rubber ducky, I'm awfully fond of. Rubber ducky, I'd like a whole pond of. Rubber ducky, I'm awfully fond of you.
Great. I should have been squeezing it in the background. Right?
In fact, it was I who was squeezing it in the background
on
those
record.
Many years ago on the record, yeah.
And Jeff Moss, you were one of the original writers on Sesame Street. When you signed on to do the show, was it understood you'd be writing songs too and that songs would be an important part of the program?
In fact, we thought that songs might be an important part of the program, but no. Joe Raposo was the original music director, and In fact, we found out we were going to use records, and we found out because it was public television, it was very hard to clear the rights to use them. So Joe came to me and said, well, look, you write words and music, I write words and music, why don't we just do it? We'll write to the curriculum, we'll do it faster. Joe was wonderfully ebullient. He said, we'll do it better, let's just go do it, and we did it.
Huh. So now you were also in on the creation of some of the characters,
mm-hmm.
like Cookie Monster.
Indeed.
And Oscar.
Indeed.
Tell us about creating Cookie Monster.
Well, Cookie Monster, Jim and his people had created the physical monsters before Sesame Street, but they had always been quite scary, and they never spoke. But they were just such wonderful puppets that I went into somebody's office one day and said, well, how about that furry blue one with the boggly eyes? Could he maybe talk? And they said, well, you know, the puppeteers don't talk very much and they're scary. And so I said, well, what if he doesn't talk very much and I try to make him funny? And they said, well, go ahead and do it. And I wrote a bit for him in which he had 2 words, and one of them was milk and the other one was cookie. And we were in the studio and Frank Oz performed him just so brilliantly we all fell off the seats, and I went back and started writing more.
Oh, I think this is a song cue. Why don't you do a Cookie Monster song?
Yeah, this is what he has for breakfast, for lunch, for dinner, but he sings about breakfast today. He says, me have a soft boiled cookie. With a glass of cookie juice on the side. Or for a change, one morning, me will have me cookies scrambled or fried. It isn't hard each morning to keep me satisfied. Just give me a soft boiled cookie, please, with a glass of cookie juice on the side.
That's great. So, was the voice your idea or Frank Oz's idea?
No. That's a poor imitation of Frank Oz, whose idea it was.
Mm-hmm. Now you co-created Oscar.
Co-created Oscar, yeah.
And how did he come about?
He came about because the educators had suggested that we have a character who showed kids that it wasn't necessary to be cheerful all the time. So a grouch was created, and it was decided that he lived in a trash can, and then we sat down and kind of created this wonderful vicious circle for him where if you make him happy, he hates that, and that makes him unhappy, but being unhappy makes him happy, so he likes that, but that makes him unhappy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Meanwhile, he has his obsession and his passion, which is Oscar sings, "Oh, I love trash. Anything dirty or dingy or dusty. Anything ragged or rotten or rusty. Oh, I love trash."
I like the idea that you put that in waltz time.
Yes, indeed. It was a good juxtaposition of trying to write a pretty waltz for a yucky character.
Did educators ever object to the fact that he was an unsanitary puppet?
Do you know, they didn't. But we think that today, if we were creating today, they might have. They might have worried that kids would crawl in garbage cans and all that. But they never did. So the writers feel that the kids can discriminate. The educators test it out. We don't.
When you were younger, you had ambitions of writing Broadway musicals?
Well, in fact, I probably did, yeah. I grew up, during the late 50s, and I can remember, my father was on the stage, my father was an actor, and I can remember.
Really? Would I know him?
Arnold Moss, his name was, and he was a Shakespearean actor, and my earliest memories are theater memories, and I can remember The King and I and that kind of stuff, but by the time I was old enough to try it, it kind of was going in a different direction than it had been going, and I found Sesame Street, and that's the direction everything went.
Broadway, I imagine, was going in the ersatz rock direction?
It was going in rock, and it was going in the area where the songs were less important, where the production was much more important, and Bob Fosse's and Tommy Tune's and those people who were brilliant, but they were the stars. They were the people who were using, the Gershwin songs rather than the new writers' songs.
Now, you got to write a Broadway musical in the sense that you wrote the songs for The Muppets Take Manhattan,
mm-hmm.
which is about
Absolutely.
The Muppets going to Manhattan to do
a Broadway
show.
Yes, at the Biltmore Theater.
did you get a chance to write the kinds of songs for that were very close to what you would have written for the stage?
I don't think so. They were more the kinds of songs that I would have written if I had been doing the Mickey Rooney, Judy Garland movies
right.
of the 30s, which is another way that one might look at Kermit and Piggy. And the show that they put on was a very glitzy Broadway show. But there was jazz in that score that I wrote. There was rock, and there was waltzes again, and kind of ragtime.
You got an Academy Award nomination for the yeah. songs that you wrote for The Muppets Take Manhattan. Let me ask you to do one of the songs from there. It's a song you wrote for Miss Piggy about how she wants to be a movie star.
Yeah, she wanted to be everything and love her man at the same time. She's saying, "I want to be a movie star, and I want to learn to drive a car. I want to be a veterinarian, too, and I'm going to always love you." And then she's saying, "I'll be the cutest model you ever saw. And then I think I'll study criminal law. And I'm going to learn to scuba dive, too, and I'm going to always love you." went on and she wanted to climb the Matterhorn, but only after all her children were born. And she wanted to be a good mommy, too, but I want to always love you.
You must have been really shocked when Jim Henson died so suddenly a few years ago.
It was awful. It was totally unexpected and as devastating as any death has been to me. I got a call from a friend of mine at 3 o'clock in the morning who said, sit down, and it's the only call. We stayed on the phone till 4 o'clock in the morning, and then I went back to bed and just didn't want to get up. Felt that if I didn't read it in the paper or didn't hear it on the radio or the TV, then it wouldn't have happened. It was a terrible loss, and it shouldn't have happened. I mean, it was, if he had been in the hospital 12 hours earlier, they would have given him penicillin and he would have been fine.
He had a bacterial infection. Was he working through that, working while he was sick?
But he was sick for 48 hours. I mean, it wasn't that he had such a phenomenal endurance that what would have sent anybody but him to the hospital to find out what was wrong, he probably just said, oh, gee, I'm feeling tired. I mean, he didn't need very much sleep. He had endless energy and was not, he was sick for a long weekend. That's all he was sick.
What happened on the show afterwards? Did you all stop working for a while?
The show, as I remember, we were not in production at the time, so I think it was the spring that he died, and we were not in production then. And just only now have new Kermit pieces begun to be done, as somebody else does Kermit, and we're seeing if we may do a few Ernie and Bert bits.
So you had thought the characters would be retired.
Well, they were retired in the sense of doing new material, but there's a library of 20-something years of them, so an average Sesame Street new show, maybe 50% of the material is new and 50% of it is from 22 years, and most of the stuff that Jim did is so classic that you wouldn't know whether it was year 3 or year 23, so the show has not felt his the lack of his presence the same way life has. Life has felt the lack of his presence.
We're featuring a 1994 interview and performance with Jeff Moss, who has written songs for Sesame Street since the series began. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jeff Moss. He's written songs for Sesame Street since the series began. Now, your first job after college, I think, was working on Captain Kangaroo as a
production
assistant.
Assistant.
What was the job description?
There was no job description. The woman who hired me said, well, we have jobs for production assistant. You could choose either the CBS News or Captain Kangaroo, and I was being very young and flip, and I said, well, I've seen the news, and I hadn't seen Kangaroo, and I did that for 6 months and then came back as a writer for a couple of years, and it was a very nice place to begin.
So when you got the job on Sesame Street, were there things you felt you wanted to do different than the way you'd seen it done on Captain Kangaroo?
Everything about Sesame Street was new. The great thing was that we had a marvelous freedom that we didn't realize we had then. This is looking back on it. But Joan Cooney had raised a lot of money that couldn't be paid to anyone in salaries but could be spent on production. And we didn't have a network that we had to please. We didn't have stars that we had to please. We didn't have sponsors that we had to please. And we were committed to doing 130 hours of television. And there were four of us wrote 90% of the first year's show. And we could just have the most wonderful time as long as we were willing to work 37 hours a day. And we just did whatever we wanted to do that stuck to the curriculum. In the early years when I was head writer, I used to say to the writers, look, the two jobs you have is one to keep the 3 to 5 year old watching the TV, and the other one is to write a show that if you were spinning the dial, you would stop and watch yourself. And that's what we did creatively from the very, very beginning.
Was every song supposed to carry a lesson with it?
Yes, and almost every song did, and almost every piece of material on Sesame Street did and does.
Do you have a song that's your favorite lyric for teaching something in a really entertaining way?
Of the recent songs that I've done, we began doing racial relations as a goal a few years ago, just several years ago, and they wanted a song that would kind of be the corner post of that. It's a film of kids at the beach, kids playing at the beach in their bathing suits, and this is the way I chose to deal with it. Skin covered all over with beautiful skin. Skin covered all over from ankle to chin. Lovely skin on knees and noses and everywhere. Skin on tummies and toeses and under your hair, it's even there. Oh, skin, wonderful colors and beautiful tones. Skin, think of without it, you're nothing but bones. Skin is ever so lovely no matter the color you're in. Let's hear it for skin. Beautiful skin, let's hear it for skin. Beautiful skin.
No, who sings that on the show?
It's the voice of Kevin Clash, who's one of the Muppets, but it's just a film of the kids playing at the beach. It's not a Muppet song.
That's a good song. Another of your little Tin Pan Alley numbers.
Yeah.
Well, you've been writing more books lately, focusing more on the books.
The last 5 years, yeah, I've done more writing of the books than I have of anything else.
Why is that?
I was asked, probably 6 or 7 years ago, Marlo Thomas was putting together a book about families, and they asked me to do something, and what I ended up doing was a long poem, and they liked it, and it was very successful. And the next time I had free time on my schedule, I began writing poems, and when I had 10 or 20, I told my wife that was what I was doing, and then I had 90 or 100, and I said, well, gee, this might be a book. But before then, because I hadn't raised children, I had not been into the bookstores to see what was out there, and I've been very fortunate. The first book was The Butterfly Jar, which is still out there and just in its 11th or 12th printing now.
And your new book is called Aronimus White. Tell us a little bit about the story, and then I want you to read the beginning of it.
Yeah, Hieronymus White, it's subtitled A Bird Who Believed That He Always Was Right, and it's about a bird who comes to believe that he always was right. It goes back to way before he was born, when his parents are very young, and goes through to the point that his granddaughter has grown up, and it shows the good things about believing you're always right and the bad things, and it traces his life and comes to a point where something happens that causes him to no longer believe that he's always right. This is the story of Hieronymus White, a bird who believed that he always was right. He was always an expert, whatever the task. He would share his advice. There was no need to ask. When his children came down with a fever or chills, he'd order the doctor to choose different pills. When the postman delivered a package or letter, Hieronymus told him how he could do better. He approached every issue so confidently, he'd seem shocked at the thought that you might not agree. Yes, all through a life that was famous and long, Hieronymus thought that he couldn't be wrong, till one day late in life when his feathers were thinning. So now let's go back to the very beginning. This is the story of Hieronymus White, a bird who believed that he always was right.
I really like that. I'm sure I know this character.
Yes, I think we all do.
This character has given me too much advice over the years. So what inspired you to write this story?
I think I wanted to write firstly about a person who believed that he always was right. I have known a number of them in my life, and sometime don't have to go too much farther than the mirror to find one. And also I wanted to write about continuity and about passing things on from one generation to the next. And I began the story, and it kind of took off and became what it became.
Let me get you to do a short grumpy poem from a previous collection of poems called The Butterfly Jar.
This is called Hi, How Are You Today? I'm feeling very horrible and low and mean and mad and dreadful and deplorable and rotten, sick and sad and nasty and unbearable and hateful, vile and blue. But thanks a lot for asking, and please tell me, how are you?
Well, it's really been a pleasure.
Me too.
Having you here on the show, I've really enjoyed it a lot. I'd love for you to end with a song, and you have actually a very sweet song about goodbyes. Maybe you can do that. Tell us first how you wrote it.
It's from The Muppets Take Manhattan, and it comes at a time when the Muppets are not being successful in their quest to become stars on Broadway, so they all have to split up and go in their various directions, and this is the song they sing. Saying goodbye, going away, seems like goodbye's such a hard thing to say. Touching a hand, wondering why it's time for saying goodbye. Saying goodbye, why is it sad? Makes us remember the good times we've had. Much more to say, foolish to try. It's time for saying goodbye. Don't want to leave, still we both know. Sometimes it's better to go. Somehow I know we'll meet again. Don't know just where, and I'm not sure just when. You're in my heart, so until then, want to smile, want to cry, saying goodbye.
Jeff Moss, recorded in 1994. In addition to writing songs for Sesame Street, he also writes books for children. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, our Words and Music series continues with the McGarrigle sisters. J.D. Considine described them as probably the finest singer-songwriter team ever to go ignored by the American public. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to continue our Words and Music series with a performance by Kate and Anna McGarrigle. Critic John Rockwell once described their music as delicate and subtle, so vulnerable and private that you sometimes want to turn your head away. He said it's the natural honesty in both their music and image that allows the sentiment in their love songs to ring so true. Both Kate and Anna write songs, sing, and play piano, guitar, and accordion. The McGarrigles grew up in Quebec and now live just outside of Montreal. They record infrequently and rarely tour. Their first album in 6 years was released over the summer. The McGarrigles first became known through songs recorded by Linda Ronstadt and Maria Moldauer. When the McGarrigles joined us in 1993, they started with a song written by Anna, which became the title track of a popular Linda Ronstadt album.
And it's only love, and it's only love.
It's a beautiful song and beautifully sung. Thank you both for doing it, Kate and Anna McGarrigle. Now, the song that you just did, Heart Like a Wheel, I think, Anna, that was the first song that you wrote?
Yeah.
It doesn't seem possible to me, you know, to start off with something that good.
Well, it's sort of an awkward little song, but anyway,
why are you calling it awkward?
Well, because it sort of moves. It changes metaphors in the first verse, you know, and it's just, I think it was just kind of written off the top of my head, and I didn't think about what I was doing.
And that's one of the songs that helped establish you commercially, I think, because Linda Ronstadt recorded it. How soon after you wrote it?
I think she recorded it in 1973,
maybe?
70? No, either 74, 75. I'm not absolutely sure.
There's another singer that helped establish your reputations, you know, as songwriters, and that's Maria Muldaur,
that's
who recorded
right.
some of your songs.
Yes.
And one of those songs was one of your songs, Kate, Mendocino.
No, she didn't.
She didn't record Mendocino?
No.
I thought she did.
The work song. Was
Linda Ronstadt recorded Mendocino later on, but the work song.
Play a few bars of that, the work song.
Right before my blues were blue and the good old songs were new, songs that may no longer please us, but the darkies up, oh Jesus.
That one?
So what was it like for you to have other people doing your songs? This was before you had started recording yourself.
Right. It was great. It was truly terrific. To have something that you've written come out. I remember Maria Muldaur did this song on the Johnny Carson show, and she said, "I'd like to thank my friend Kate McGarrigle for writing," something like that. And I was just
thrilled.
So how did you start performing your own songs after other people started doing them?
Well, and the second, on Maria's second record, there was a song she, at this point, what she did or what her producers did, they said, well, the first record worked so well, let's get some more songs from the same writers. So it was David Nickturn and myself and a bunch of other people. And so I gave her a tape and she learned this song called Cool River, and they flew me out. And I wasn't sure what song they were doing. They said, come out and play the piano. And I got to the studio and they were in the session with about six, you know, heavy duty musicians. And they said, play the piano, please. And I said, I don't know the song. And they said, well, I thought you wrote it. You gave us the tape. I said, no, that's my sister Anna. And they didn't really know about Anna. And they said, well, where is she? I said, in Montreal. And they actually said, do you think she'd come out here if we called her up? And I called you, right?
I was only too happy to take an airplane. I think I brought my accordion out with me.
And so she came out, and at that point, we'd already changed the arrangement. But since we were both there, we sang backup on her version. And that came out on her second record, Waitress in a Donut Shop. And then Greg Prestipino, who was working, helping her get songs, said, can I bring the girls into the studio since they're both out here? And that all happened in a week. And literally we went in, put down maybe six or seven songs that we had written, not really knowing each other's songs that much, but, you know, Anna would have the lyric sheets to my songs. She would sing harmony. I'd sing harmony to her songs. That's why we all ended up singing our own songs at the piano.
We're listening to a 1993 concert and interview with Kate and Anna McGarrigle. Their latest album is called Matipedia. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our concert and interview with Kate and Anna McGarrigle. Let me skip ahead a little bit, and let's hear a more recent song than the song we opened with. And Kate, this is one of your songs. It's called I Eat Dinner. Do you want to say anything about writing it, Kate, before we hear it?
Everybody thinks the song's about me, but it's actually about Frida Kahlo. I know Anna says she'll...
Painter?
Yeah.
The painter?
Yeah, there's an excerpt in the biography of her by Hayden Herrera. Saying where she's between husbands and lovers, or somebody's left her, or at this point two people have left her, and she writes a letter to a friend saying, for the first time in my life, I'm having dinner by myself at the kitchen table without any candles on it. I mean, it was just, it was the vision, because this woman had her life full. And
so Kate said, let me see now. I haven't got anybody in my life right now. I have a very pokey little kitchen with a little round table. And I just happened to have a daughter. So, but it was, I think, Kate says it's not really about her, but it, I think it is.
I don't eat leftovers.
That's true.
Why don't we hear the song?
Never thought that I'd end up this way. I who love the sparks. Never thought my hair'd be turned into gray. It used to be so dark. So potatoes, no more candlelight, no more romance, no more small talk when the hunger's gone. When the hunger's gone, I eat dinner at the kitchen table and I wash it down. I eat leftovers with mashed potatoes. No more candlelight, no more romance, no more small talk when the hunger stops. When the hunger stops. Never thought that I'd end up like this. Kitchen table with my daughter, who is now 17. We eat leftovers with mashed potatoes. No more candlelight, no more romance, no more small talk when the plate is clean. No more candlelight, no more romance, no more small talk when the hunger is gone. 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 When the hunger is gone.
It's Kate and Anna McGarrigle. What a wonderful song. And I guess maybe, Kate, it's a little bit about you and a little bit about Frida Kahlo.
Well, yes, I suppose so.
I want to get back to where we were before, that you hadn't started performing together till after you recorded backup vocals for Maria Muldaur. I imagine as kids you sang and performed, or at least in the house together?
Yeah, we actually, I mean... our father thought it very important that we know how to sing and play. I don't know why, but our parents played at parties for people. I mean, like, they weren't professional musicians, but my mother had a very lovely singing voice, and he would always accompany her, and they'd sing, you know, party songs, kind of. And he was very, very musical. Our father was very musical. And he would teach us songs, and which we thought were dreadfully boring at the time, but he'd actually say, you know, I'll give you a nickel if you learn this song, or something like that. But he would, he found it very important to teach us what he knew, the songs that he knew.
What kind of songs did you think of as boring that he taught you?
Oh, well, the stuff that he liked really was stuff that was pre... So my father was born in 1899. Our father was born in 1899. And he was in the First War. So in a way, there was a whole period in there of kind of sentimental ballads of people going away and a lot of them not coming back. I mean, my mother remembering her mother crying because her brother was killed at Passchendaele. And that kind of... And there were many songs that we heard later, like an old John McCormick record and stuff, but mostly American songs that had to do with people going away, I guess because of that war. That was the first kind of war, which included Stephen Foster songs and that kind of stuff.
Do you think that's responsible at all for the melancholy strain in so many of your songs?
Absolutely. We were explaining last night, we sang a song, I should say in the context of the tour that we're on, a song called Gentle Annie by Stephen Foster, and I sort of said this was the first song I remember my father playing or hearing, and of course he taught it to us, and Kate sort of jokingly said other people had songs, you know, sort of happy sort of children's songs, and I said we always had songs about death. But I mean, we were an incredibly happy family. Nobody is really sad in our family. I think we're all sort of fairly well adjusted. And
there's a new song that you have that's very much in the kind of folk ballad tradition. It even uses a lot of phrases from traditional ballads. I think this would be a good time to ask you to sing it. Which of you wrote it?
I wrote it. Anna wrote it. And I call it Appalachian Dream, and it's about growing up in the Laurentians and dreaming about Appalachia.
And when did you write this?
In the last month and a half.
And let's hear it. This is a song by Anna McGarrigle. Anna is on guitar and vocals, and Kate is on vocals and banjo.
Yes, I must also want to say that it's kind of all a tribute to some people who were in our lives, not who we didn't really know necessarily or know well, but like the mention, there's Pete Seeger, who's kind of like the Bells of Rimney, and Johnny Carignan, who was a fiddler who plays the Hangman's Reel, and various people like that we knew as when we were teenagers, that loomed very large in our lives with the songs they sang and the music they played.
Let's hear it. This is Appalachian Dream.
Bye.
weeping and a pining for love. Frail my heart apart and play me little shady grove. Ring the bells of Rimney till they ring inside my head forever. Bounce the bowl, rock the gallows for the hangman's reel. And wake the devil from his dream. I'm going back to Harlan. I'm going back to Harlan. I'm going back to Harlan. I'm going back to Harlan.
That's Appalachia Dream, as performed in our studio by Kate and Anna McGarrigle in 1993. We'll return to their performance after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Kate and Anna McGarrigle.
Some of your songs seem pretty personal. And Kate, let me ask you this. You were married to Loudon Wainwright for a while.
That's right. Yeah.
And he's the father of your daughter.
And my son.
And your son. Mm-hmm. And he writes very personal songs too. And some of those songs seem to be about you.
The earlier, nastier ones, to be honest.
Right. How do you feel about that?
Oh, I just got asked this recently. Well, you know, I kind of have trouble sometimes separating Loudon the person from Loudon the songwriter.
Uh-huh.
I mean, he's a brilliant songwriter, especially when he's writing nasty songs about people. I mean, that's really where he's at his best. So he's really turned out some very good, nasty songs about me. And sometimes I kind of had to pull way back, you know. I mean, I guess. But now I see that he kind of writes songs about my kids. And, I don't know. I mean, I think Loudon just likes or has to write songs about people who are, you know, who are around him.
Did you ever try to write a nasty song about him?
I don't have that kind of heart. No, wit.
I think Kate makes herself more sort of like the victim rather than she doesn't go after the person so much. So it's kind of sweeter what comes out.
Let me ask you to close with another song from
Heartbeats. Yeah, Accelerating.
Heartbeats Accelerating. And the song is Love Is. Before you perform it for us, this is a song that was written by both of you and
our sister Jane.
Your other sister Jane. Mm-hmm. How did you collaborate on it?
Anna and Janie wrote this. I actually wrote one line.
She wrote the best line.
And wasn't it generous of them to give you credit?
Very generous. I thank them very much. I really do.
Anna, anything about how the song is written?
No, one day I went to Jane's house. I said, let's write a song. I started writing it. And then when she got off the telephone, she contributed.
She's our manager.
A chord change. And then she went back and I just continued. So it was a collaboration.
And who's playing what on this?
Kate is playing the nylon string guitar. And
singing backup?
That's right, singing backup. And I'm playing the piano and singing.
Lead.
Front up.
Okay. Well, before we hear Love Is, let me thank you both a lot for doing the concert. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much.
My guests have been Kate and Anna McGarrigle, and here they are to perform one last song for us.
Love is a shiny car. Love is a steel guitar. Love is a battle scar. Love is the morning star. Love is a 12-bar blues. Love is your blue suede shoes. Love is a heart abuse. Love is a mind confused. Love is the pleasures untold, and for some, love is still a band of gold.
That's Love Is, performed by Kate and Anna McGarrigle in our studio in 1993. Our Words and Music series will continue tomorrow. We'll close today's show with a title song from the McGarrigle's latest album, Metapedia. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Bob Purdick, Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, Al Banks, and Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Merry Christmas from all of us at Fresh Air.
Her hair was dyed black and she was bending down, picking something from off the ground. She was 17, but he said, "Oh my God, it's Kate." She said, "No, I'm the daughter of Kate. My name is Martha. Who are you?" Not a
Once upon a time, two kids in love in a car, flying over mountains, trying to catch a boat, take them upriver to home. And they raised a mother.
On the next Fresh Air, Willie Nelson, as we continue our week-long series Words and Music, featuring songwriters performing and discussing their own songs. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
On the road again, going places that I've never been.